From NPR and WBUR, I'm Femi Okay.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Femi, it is great to have you here with us this week. Of course, our listeners know you from your weekly appearances.
They do, indeed.
And from Al Jazeera English's The Stream, which you host. But today, we're talking about a lot of topics, including some late-breaking news on the big story, President Trump's immigration policy.
And there I was thinking that I would have to scale down my Twitter action, but President Trump again attacked the Democrats on Twitter this morning over his policy of separating kids from their parents at the southern border. This is what he said. "It's the Democrats' fault," he tweeted. "They won't give us the votes needed to pass good immigration legislation. They want open borders, which breeds horrible crime. Republicans want security, but I am working on something it never ends, exclamation mark. In fact, existing law does not call for the separation of children. And what exactly the president is working on remains unknown even to Congress. House Republicans met with the president yesterday to go over two different immigration bills, neither of which got a full endorsement from the president. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell also said that he'd pursue narrow legislation with Democrats to change the border policy, which Minority Leader Chuck Schumer shot down, saying that President Trump should end family separations through his own action. So, to untangle all of this, we're joined by NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell. Kelsey, what's the latest that you can tell us?
Well, this has been a confusing string of days, with the president going back and forth on his policies and really leaving Congress scrambling to keep up with him. The latest is that the House Republicans say that they are going to vote still tomorrow on a pair of immigration bills. One is that moderate bill or compromise bill, depending upon who's describing it, that would solve all four of Trump's pillars, including building a wall on the southern border and giving legal protections to the immigrants who are in the country illegally after being brought here as children. We commonly call them dreamers. That would include some sort of way to keep families together as they're coming through and at border crossings. Now, there is another bill, a more conservative bill, commonly heard of as the Goodlatte bill. Thing to remember about both of these bills is that neither of them looks to have the votes to pass. So at this point, what we're talking about is a political exercise of sorts so that Republicans can be on the record saying that they have done something.
But it's also possible, Kelsey, that the president might sign something on his own.
Yes, there is some reporting right now that the president came through the White House and told reporters that he's looking to sign something by the end of the day on family separation. We don't know exactly what that is and how it will be handled, but he has apparently spoken to some reporters about it.
So the House Speaker Paul Ryan talked about stopping the separations by passing law so it would give jurisdiction to the Department of Homeland Security instead of the Justice Department.
That's right.
Tomorrow, the House will vote on legislation to keep families together. Under this bill, when people are being prosecuted for illegally crossing the border, families will remain together under DHS custody throughout the length of their legal proceedings.
Kelsey?
Yes, that's right. So he also said that it's his preference to keep families together. And that's something that he's been saying for quite some time. Now, the issue here, as you mentioned earlier, is that they don't need to pass a law to do this. It is a matter of administration policy. And that, as you said, is what Democrats have been saying since this all began. Now, there is a question, though, about whether or not it's easier and more long term to pass a law and to explicitly say that children and their parents should be kept together.
So, as you said, the Democrats have demanded that President end this policy immediately. Here's Senator Chris Coons of Delaware. He was speaking to CNN this morning. Have a listen.
It is really hard to swallow the idea that somehow this is my responsibility, Democrats' responsibility, to come even farther President Trump's way because of the cruel way children are being treated. The solutions being put forward by Republican senators this week would instead incarcerate in pretrial detention whole families.
So much going on. What are your sources telling you, Kelsey?
At this point, it seems like the Republicans would like to do a surgical approach if they can, something to just address this issue. At least they want to do that in the Senate. But if the president is able to act and is able to let some of the pressure off, it may mean that immigration bills don't actually end up happening until after the election at the very earliest. It's important to remember that this is not a new issue for Congress. Immigration has bedeviled Congress for more than a decade, and this is just a continuation of those disagreements.
Thank you, NPR congressional reporter Kelsey Snell.
Well, let's turn now to someone who was right on the front lines of this policy, working at an immigrant children's shelter in Arizona. He quit his job last week in protest. Antar Davidson joins us. Antar, this shelter was already dealing with kids arriving unaccompanied, but tell us how you noticed the rollout of the new zero tolerance policy.
When you're in a job as intense as this, you don't really care about the news. So you get home, you want to chill, you wake up in the morning, you want to prepare for your job. So I was fairly out of the news cycle as this happened. I only noticed the difference based on a very noticeable uptick in general behavioral issues at the shelter. More and more young kids were coming. They were behaving more and more traumatized. One thing that I really want people to understand is the audio clip that came out that was so grating to everyone's ears, that's something that we began to hear every single night, were kids crying like that. And so it just became at a point too much. When the organization was basically handling it more with an authoritarian approach and a very bad approach to this, I decided that I could no longer be part of the organization.
Well, what do you mean by that? What were they doing that you thought was worth quitting over?
There was a night in which the first Brazilians of the facility came, and they were 16, 10, and 8. They had just been separated from their mother the night before. They weren't given a bed the entire day. I was the only person that spoke Portuguese to them. So they, in the night, after not having slept all day and not being given a bed, they were told that they would be separated, all three of them, in a different room. They were told in kind of broken Spanish. So they understood that they would just be separated. So the two younger siblings, they had grasped the older brother, and they were all three crying, and they wouldn't, like, break up. And they called me to come over and translate to these kids that they weren't allowed to hug, to which I responded, I don't know that that's what I'm going to say, but I'm on my way to help. I arrived before the shift leader to this scene of these three siblings holding desperately onto each other. The little siblings saying, you know, we don't, please, like, where's our mom? Please don't separate us, like, to their brother. Please, can we stay with you? And I came up to him and I said, bro, I know this is a tough situation, but you have to be strong in this situation. You have to be strong for your brother and sister. And he looks at me with tears in his eyes and he says, how? He looks me dead in my eyes and says, how? How can I be strong in a situation like this? Where's my mom? To which I could only respond by basically just putting my head down. And then the shift leader arrived, and she very aggressively told me, diles que no pueden abrazar. Tell them they can't hug. And I told her directly, no. As a human, I can't do that. You're welcome to do it yourself. To which she responded to me that she was going to report me to the shift supervisor. And she immediately went over to these kids crying and imminently being separated. She felt it was appropriate to remind these kids that she should enforce the no-touch policy that the organization had. I realized at that moment that was something that I couldn't be involved in. Right. I only stayed two more days, and on Tuesday, I handed in my resignation as a conscientious objector.
So, Antar, did you think, though, at any point that maybe it'd be better if you were to stay in there so that you could help out the situation rather than leaving?
Of course. I had a huge, very successful capoeira class. I spoke to many kids. I took a very strong initiative to get to know these kids, to learn their names. The reason I didn't quit earlier was because I would come home and I would tell my fiance, like, just different things that were happening and how badly I wanted to quit. And she said, like, if you leave, who's going to provide for these kids what you've provided? This instance illustrated to me that until that time, I had been able to provide a very special service to these kids, which was the capoeira. I was teaching English classes, vocational classes. I was able to do that without being told to do things that would go against my morals. But at that moment, when I was told to tell these kids not to hug, I realized that if I stayed, despite the good I was doing, in order to keep the job, I was going to have to start doing things that I felt that were very much against my morals. And I realized that it's not just my morals that these actions are against, but ultimately against the morals of the entire world.
I just want to ask you one more thing. The argument in favor of this policy is that it's got to be a deterrent for people. That this is the only way that you're going to stop people from coming into the country illegally. How do you respond to that?
I guess that they talk about border security. That's the kind of border security and ideas that a person who lives thousands of miles from the border and sits behind a security detail thinks. I live 60 miles from the border. I live in a regular two-bedroom house. No one's more concerned about border security than me. but it completely ignores the reality. The majority of people coming here are escaping these gangs and these organizations that we're supposed to be protecting from. This trauma and this sort of behavior enacted on children now give these kids who perhaps might have joined a gang like this for economic reasons, now gives them ideological reasons, and in the long run is essentially making us much less safe. The idea that this is a deterrent is completely detached from the reality. The less enemies you create, the more secure you are. In this instance, we're creating enemies.
That's Antar Davidson, who used to work in a children's shelter for unaccompanied minors who had come across the border. He quit that job after the Trump administration's zero tolerance policy. Antar, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
The Trump administration is stepping up its trade dispute with China. On Monday, President Trump asked his trade representative to fine $200 billion of Chinese goods to hit with tariffs. That's on top of tariffs on steel and aluminum and on $50 billion of goods that take effect next month. Those tariffs target manufactured goods like machinery and electrical equipment. But for years, China's economy has been shifting away from heavy industry and toward its services sector. For more on that, we're joined by Mary Lovely, a professor of economics at Syracuse University. Welcome. And first of all, just how big is China's service sector today?
Well, the service sector is now the largest sector in China, accounting for over 50% of its national income. Now, that's compared to 40% for industry and manufacturing, things that we traditionally associate with China. But it's still far below the 70 to 80% that we see in developed countries like the United States. That's being driven by a whole host of different sectors, and they have very different implications for the Chinese economy and its growth.
Well, give us an example of some of the jobs that are being added in China right now.
Well, some of the, you know, exciting jobs are things like in what we call fintech. So it will be things like in online payments or using your cell phone to do a whole host of things, you know, call a DD, which is their version of Uber, or pay for your dinner. So there are exciting jobs in finance, exchange rate trading, stock trading, providing other kinds of services to households. But then there's things that are very low productivity and don't pay much, things like cleaning hotel rooms because tourism is booming in China, or working in a little restaurant.
And is this growth in the service sector because of some central strategy from the government in Beijing, or is this just happening organically?
Well, both. It's part of China's rebalancing strategy, which is to move away from export-led growth toward consumption-led growth. And this, is something that the world economy has been urging China to do so that it runs a smaller external surplus with the rest of the world. China has been very successful in that. Right now, its external surplus is down to about 1.4% of GDP, which is quite low. And many observers are predicting that, in fact, China will run a trade deficit within the next 10 years.
But as the service sector there grows, are wages going up? What is this doing to consumers in China, to the price of things, and to the middle class?
Inflation is probably higher than the official statistics, but in terms of whether it is, you know, which sectors are growing, where are wages growing, again, it's a very diverse picture. We have traditional sectors which have a high state ownership share. They're very highly regulated, very inefficient. Things like education, healthcare, transport. So these are very important services that are provided, and yet productivity is very low. Then, of course, we have the non-traditional and new and innovative services, which I mentioned earlier, like finance and logistics. And then we'd still have a whole bunch of low value-added services like the little restaurants and cleaning and other types of personal services. And those are dominated by very small, often informal, that is not registered firms.
Obviously, China's manufacturing sector is very reliant on countries like the United States buying goods from China. What about the service sector? If the U.S., you know, starts to heat up a trade war with China and puts tariffs on a lot of things, is that going to hit that service sector in China as well?
Yes, it is, because exports are one way they hope to ramp up production and have customers who want to buy it, in particular business services. Right now, they both import and export services. They import more than they export. Some of the services they import from us are things that people might not think of as services, but it's fees for using our technology, mm-hmm. royalties. So they import a lot. They want to export more, more tourists going there, more business services that are in support of foreign investors there. So, for example, you know, Japanese banks might be there operating, but they're basically operating in support of their enterprises that are operating in the country. So to the extent that foreign investment slows down, demand for domestically produced services to support that foreign involvement in the economy will also slow. So the trade, I don't know if we call it a war, skirmish, conflict, whatever the word of the day is definitely a challenge for China's rebalancing strategy.
So I was in China recently, and I remember checking into a big Western hotel, and it felt like there were a lot more people doing the same amount of work that one person would do in a hotel in the United States like that. I wonder if that speaks to something that's going on in the service sector there, that they're trying to employ a lot of people in an industry that we've discovered we don't need quite as many in this country, but right now maybe they do.
Yeah, that is a phenomenon, and it's a funny thing for Americans to experience. Of course, it's much better than it was before. But what we see is that, you know, if you add a certain amount of national income by developing services, you create a lot of jobs. So it's a job-creating mechanism. Just flip that over. What that means is that it's very low productivity in that sector. It takes a lot of workers to produce, you know, a dollar of GDP. That's much different than in manufacturing. So they have a long way to go in services and raising productivity.
That's Mary Lovely, who's a professor of economics at Syracuse and a fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, it's shaping up to be another busy fire season in the West after a record-breaking season last year in terms of cost. One of the ways firefighters try to limit the impact is by doing controlled forest burns. But as a result of that, last summer, residents and tourists in much of the West choked on foul air due to heavy smoke. Jefferson Public Radio's Leah Moriarty looks now at whether people are ready to put up with more smoke from prescribed burns.
I'm standing with John Larson on a steep northern slope on federal land in the Applegate Valley in southwestern Oregon. He's overseeing a prescribed fire that's slowly burning through woody debris on the forest floor.
What we're looking at right here is a really light, cool sort of underburn to reduce the finer fuels.
The fire isn't very hot, but it's plenty smoky, and Larson and I daub our stinging eyes and runny noses as we walk the edge of the 138-acre burn. Larson is a fire management specialist with the Bureau of Land Management. He says that, given the proximity to local communities, it's important not only to keep the fire under control, but also to minimize impacts from the smoke.
You have to look at really where the smoke is going to go, and mainly that concern is at nighttime and in the morning hours. The smoke wants to tend to settle into the low drainage areas.
Larson says that, for the most part, the locals know why his crew is adding fire to the valley and don't register many complaints about the additional smoke. In other communities in the West, land managers aren't so lucky.
The last time we had prescribed burning, besides piles, in the Rattlesnake was in the 90s, and the public was really unhappy with us.
That's Jan Hensick, the Missoula District Ranger at the Lolo National Forest in western Montana. She says the negative public reaction to prescribed burning 20 years ago is one reason that officials are only recently putting fire back on the ground in the Rattlesnake Creek area near Missoula. A lingering smoke fatigue in the community after weeks of unhealthy air from wildfires last summer doesn't help either. Hensick says the new push is accompanied by an intense public outreach and education effort.
Utilizing social media tools, all of our mailing lists for mountain bike and running clubs, things like that. We are also knocking on neighbors' doors all over the place, leaving them maps, hanging flyers. It's a lot of work.
Hensick is trying to build what she calls social capital to get locals on board with the growing consensus that one way to have less destructive wildfire is to use controlled burning to help reestablish fire's natural place in the forest ecosystem. Recent research bolsters that case. The Fire Sciences Laboratory at the U.S. Forest Service has found that thinning overstocked forests isn't by itself enough to significantly reduce wildfire severity. Only when fuel reduction is followed by prescribed burning does treated acreage burn more moderately. Robert Yokelson, an atmospheric chemist at the University of Montana, co-authored a study published last year that suggests smoke from prescribed burns is more benign than wildfire smoke.
With prescribed fires, you'll make less pollution for the same area burned, and you can also burn those fires under conditions when you can control where the smoke goes better.
Still, Missoula Ranger Jen Hensick says it's a heavy lift to get a program of prescribed burning established.
You take on a lot of liability, whether it's smoke management or impact to private lands, those sorts of things. So outside of the fact that we want to do this and we're passionate about it for our community and this is what science tells us needs to be done, there's really not a lot of incentive to do it.
Chris Chambers can feel her pain. Chambers is with the Ashland, Oregon Fire Department. He has a major role in Ashland's ongoing program to restore much of the 15,000-acre watershed on the city's doorstep. And he says a lot of meticulous planning goes into timing a prescribed burn.
You know, we're not doing it in the middle of the summer. We're not doing it at times of the year where we know smoke is going to be a significant issue for the community, or at least not on days when we know it will be, so that we're trying to keep as much smoke away from the community as we possibly can.
Chambers says that as a more natural fire ecology is reestablished, and as the climate continues to warm, people across the West are going to have to choose whether to accept a little smoke from prescribed burns now or endure entire summers of wildfire smoke later. For Here and Now, I'm Liam Moriarty in Ashland, Oregon.
The news can feel like an echo chamber. You listen to podcasts to get that perspective shift. So travel with NPR's Rough Translation. Follow familiar conversations in unfamiliar parts of the world and get a new perspective on home. Rough Translation. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Florida could become the home of the largest mall in the U.S. Miami-Dade County Commissioners have approved plans for American Dream Miami. It may be the most expensive mall ever built, with an estimated cost of $4 billion. On site, there will be 2,000 hotel rooms, an indoor ski slope, and a water park. Doug Hanks of the Miami Herald has been following this story. Hi, Doug. This sounds like a mall for people who don't like shopping much.
Well, it's got a lot of shopping, so the developer definitely needs people who love to shop to go there to make their money. But there's a lot of options that aren't shopping, including... I mean, such a long list, but there's submarine rides.
No way.
In an artificial lake, yes. Mm-hmm. Now, this is all in the plans. An artificial beach. This is in Miami, you know, great beach town. But you can also go west into the suburbs and get on a beach inside a mall as well, if you want to. And I'm sure a lot of people will want to.
So this project was conceived some while ago, before people started to shop more online. So what is the attraction for something that's going to cost so much money and take so long to finish?
Well, that's been a big question. Is this a bold business plan of another era, with Amazon looming over every bricks and mortar retailer? It is worth noting, though, that Miami retail is considered a bright spot because we have so many foreign shoppers from Latin America. One of our biggest malls, in fact, our biggest mall right now, the Aventura Mall, is doing a big expansion. And you just see millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars churn through these stores because of people who arrive from Latin America with empty suitcases, fly back with them full.
Doug, any objections?
Oh, gosh, so many objections. This is I call it a retail theme park that would be built at the very edge of the suburbs, on just the eastern side of what's called the urban development boundary, which is sacrosanct to environmentalists and smart growth advocates in Miami, who just don't want sprawl getting closer and closer to the Everglades. And here we have the largest project in Miami-Dade County history going right on the edge in an area that right now is just sort of wetlands and undeveloped, and there's nothing there. It'll be wedged between two major highways. Traffic is already a total disaster out there. And they're predicting, critics are saying it's going to get a lot worse once this number one tourist destination goes up.
What's the earliest, Doug, that people can expect to go shopping to go in a submarine, to go on a fake beach?
Well, I think the start of the next decade was the optimistic projections. But, I mean, even on the regulatory side, they have a ways to go. And you have to get the financing for this. So we'll see. I mean, they cleared a major, major political hurdle by having the local elected officials endorse it. We'll see what comes next.
Doug Hanks, the Miami Herald. Thanks for being on Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
And we've been doing some looking up. The largest shopping mall in America, well, that is King of Prussia. That's outside of Philadelphia. 2.9 million square feet. Number two on the list is the one Doug just mentioned, Aventura Mall. And then that is just 14 miles from the site of the future American dream, Miami Mall. Your thoughts? Share them with us. Jump online at hereandnow.org.
Canada has become the first industrialized country in the world to legalize recreational marijuana. Yesterday, the Canadian Senate approved a law that will make it legal for adults to use the drug coast to coast. And economists say that will unlock a $7 billion market. Marijuana has been legal in Canada for medical use since 2001, but now Canadian businesses are in a race to meet the new demand. Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd visited the headquarters of Canada's largest marijuana company just before the historic vote.
If you want to see the product behind the green wave that's sweeping Canada, you've got to wash your hands, put on a lab coat, and wrap booties around your shoes.
Sanitize your feet.
All right. Only then will Jordan Sinclair let you through the door at Canopy Growth, about an hour outside Ottawa.
And we're standing inside our headquarters in Smiths Falls, Ontario, so we're inside of the world's largest grow-op.
All right, let's see it. The space we're walking through was once a storage warehouse, shelving units, floor to ceiling.
This was a chocolate factory before we bought it.
And it doesn't smell like one anymore.
It doesn't. No, it smells a little bit more botanical now.
It's been 10 years since the Hershey's company shut down its chocolate factory in the little town of Smiths Falls and shipped the jobs to Mexico. And boy, have things changed around here.
So this is the mom room.
As in mother plants. Through the glass, there's a worker.
He's doing the cloning process right now.
With a scalpel in his hand.
He's taking cuts of the plants and then dipping into a little bit of hormones that'll promote root growth. That little soil pod will be the clone's home for the next 2 or 3 weeks. It'll establish its own root system, and then once that's the case, it'll be genetically identical to the mom that it came from. And then as you grow it out and it produces flowers, you've got a product line. It's kind of nice. It's like rhythmic to watch. Yeah.
And you've got the names of these moms here, Candyland. So that's like one of your strains of cannabis.
That's right. The way that we treat it is those are the street names. The black market has been in charge of doing all the marketing up until now. So you get stuff like Candyland and Green Crack and AK-47, all those fun ones. And then we use that sort of as like the Latin. So we put it in brackets on our packaging so that if people are seeking that, they can find it. But we do our own branding that's a little bit more mature.
So that's so interesting. You're taking pot that you could find on the street,
yep,
and you're recreating it here.
Yeah, well, the genetics have to come from somewhere, and the legal system is not that old. So we had to start with cannabis genetics that came from the illicit market.
That gives you an idea how quickly Canada's industry has evolved from shadowy street corner to legitimate global enterprise. Canopy has been growing and selling medical marijuana for just 4 years, but it's already operating in 10 different countries. And on May 24th this year, it became the first marijuana company to go public on the New York Stock Exchange. Toronto-based competitor Cronos was the first to list on NASDAQ in February. It is a privilege that American cannabis companies do not have because federal law in the U.S. still prohibits the drug.
How big of a milestone was it for you and for the industry to list on the New York Stock Exchange?
Well, it was huge.
This is Canopy CEO Bruce Linton.
When you start a marijuana company, you should recognize you're exiting prohibition, and there's quite a lot of kind of gravitational pull attaching you and pulling you back to prohibition. So what you have to do is borrow everyone's credibility. And if you think about credibility, if you can go to the same bell as Rockefeller rang, that's kind of as good as it gets. So when I try to establish this business globally, points of reference include Hershey, but they for sure now include New York Stock Exchange.
You know what's interesting about that? you're a Canadian company that's listing on the New York Stock Exchange. Your competitors in the United States are not even allowed in the same building.
Right.
How much of a competitive advantage does that give you?
Well, in some senses, I have a material competitive disadvantage because I can't participate in America. So the reason we're allowed to list on New York Stock Exchange is we operate a business that's fully lawfully complying with every federal, state, and municipal law in any jurisdiction it does operate. So we're in Germany because it's federally permissible. I must always say no thank you to opportunities in America because they're not federally legal. And so you can imagine there are quite a few compelling opportunities to which we can't participate.
And the gap between Canada and the U.S. is growing. Yesterday, Canada became the first G7 country to legalize recreational marijuana. Sales could begin in 8 to 12 weeks. Linton's had several years to prepare for this, but in the early days, the thought of it nearly made him sick.
I almost felt panicked and nauseous. And the reason I was nervous was I knew we were preparing, but I knew for sure we had to be ready. And so we went from high gear to top gear. We now have about 6 million square feet. About 70% of that is greenhouses. We have gone from about, at that time, 300 employees to 1,000 employees. I just feel like Canada now for us is simply execution. There's nothing new we have to do, just more.
Canadian businesses have become by far the largest cannabis businesses in the world.
Chris Crane runs Forefront Ventures, a cannabis investment firm based in the U.S. He says some of the hype in Canada is justified, but some of it is just hype. Canopy has been valued at more than $6 billion, but its revenue was less than $40 million last year, and just $12 million the year before that.
There is a bit of a bubble right now, it seems like, and everyone kind of expects that at some point that's going to burst. The Canadian valuations are very hard to justify.
Canada has become such a hot destination for investors that American cannabis companies are turning to the Canadian Securities Exchange to raise money. But Crane and analysts following Canada's green wave say a day of reckoning is coming. Even Canopy's CEO Bruce Linton says, yes, the days ahead will be turbulent for smaller companies.
You know, markets are funny, right? They basically, right now, they're voting. I'm in favor of marijuana. But pretty soon they start weighing. How much are you making? How dominant are you? How much of a future do you have? You better be a real business.
He argues that Canopy is legit and well-positioned to snag a huge share of the market. Now that prohibition is over, Linton predicts Canada will go from 300,000 medical marijuana users to an estimated 5 million recreational users.
You execute first out of the gate. What we're talking about is prohibition ending globally. And the number one company in terms of packaged goods for consumers and medical research and new products is us.
But you haven't made a profit yet.
Oh, I have avoided being profitable. It would be like winning the warm-up. You'd have to be a nut to try and be profitable for the stretching exercise we've been doing because it would mean I'm reducing how much I spend on creating the potential to be really big. And so I've been really clear with investors. If you want a dividend, buy a bank. If you want dominance, buy Canopy.
Back on the production floor, I get one final look at the plant that's responsible for a global industry blooming across Canada. Ooh, the vault. Jordan Sinclair brings me to the vault, one of the most secure places in the building. Inside, workers in lab coats are checking the quality of the product before it goes out the door. Sinclair picks up a bag of dried bud.
So this
is not something you see every day.
It is definitely not. No. So this
maybe
is,
you did.
I still get a big smile on my face. So this is Hindu Kush. So a very popular strain.
It's a vacuum packed package you've got going on here.
Vacuum packed.
Can I touch
so,
it?
So yeah, give it a little squeeze.
Wow. How much is this?
So that is 689 grams, and we sell this for $6 a gram. So
let's do the math.
Yeah, rough math. That's about.
Give us a second. $4,100. So the product we're looking at right now,
yep.
It goes all over the world.
It does, yeah. So this Hindu Kush here is sold as Baker Street. You can walk into any one of 1,000 pharmacies in Germany today, and you can buy Baker Street from a German pharmacist that's been prescribed to you by a German doctor.
It strikes me that the ability to export this product around the world is what makes what's happening in Canada so much different than any kind of operation like this that you would see in the United States. Does that sound right to you?
That's 100% right, yeah. So the the ability for us to export, the ability for us to create, you know, a center of expertise in Canada is the prime differentiator. So our federal system sets us head and shoulders above what's happening in the States. It's an advantage for us in some ways because, you know, we're similar countries, similar cultures, similar demographics, but you guys have way more people and you got way more money. So if you were to create a federal system, it would have been hard for us to compete, which is nice. You know, we've got hockey and now we got weed. Yeah.
The national plant.
That was Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd reporting from the headquarters of Canopy Growth in Smith Falls, Ontario. Tomorrow, we'll go outside the factory to hear how people feel about Canopy coming to town and the legalization of marijuana in Canada. Fox News is being criticized for how it's covering the Trump administration's policy of separating children and parents who have crossed the border into the U.S. illegally. And some of that criticism is coming from within the Fox media empire, which includes 21st Century Fox movie and TV studios. Joining us now is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
And let's start with Seth MacFarlane, the creator of the show Family Guy, was one of the first to speak out. He tweeted that he was embarrassed to work for 21st Century Fox, ended up donating $2.5 million to public radio after Fox News host Tucker Carlson said this on his show on Friday.
Keep this in mind. If you're looking to understand what's actually happening in this country, always assume the opposite of whatever they're telling you on the big news stations. And that's certainly the case here. They're lying.
Now, in this case, Carlson was actually talking about the Inspector General's report about the handling of the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails, not about immigration. But was that a tipping point that got others to start speaking out against Fox News?
I think certainly Seth MacFarlane's stepping out and being as visceral and as blunt in his disgust for what he saw on Fox News has been something of a tipping point. Ironic little side note, Tucker Carlson has told me a couple of times over the years he's a consistent donor to public radio up in Maine where he has a vacation house and has for many years. So Tucker Carlson gives to public radio also. But here's a moment at which Tucker Carlson is essentially trying to knock the pegs out of other media, at least on his, you know, highly rated Fox program in the evening. MacFarlane's simply wasn't going to stand for it. I tweeted a bit about his statements, and not knowing that a couple hours later there would be an announcement that he had given this $2 million gift to NPR and to $500,000 to one of our big stations out in Los Angeles, KPCC. So this is a moment at which other people came forth. Paul Feig, who's you know, has done the Heat and the Spy franchises for Fox, their studios wing, said, you know, similar things. Doesn't want to be associated with Fox in that way. And Steve Levitan, also you know, the force behind Modern Family. Has made similar noises, although it's a little unclear there.
David, you tweeted earlier that this is Fox's civil war. Has there been another one?
Well, you know, I think that what you're seeing is tension between, and it's good to hear your voice on the air here, Femi, but this tension between the entertainment wings and the Fox News wings of the Murdoch Fox empire. And what makes it, you know, something that is wild to see stretch in the open is that over the years, Rupert less so, but perhaps James Murdoch the most, and at times Lachlan, those are his two sons, have had to go and sort of soothe the ruffled waters. You know, they say Hollywood's filled with liberals. You got to kind of, you know, pat them on the back, hold their hand, let them know. This is really erupting into the open in a way where the outrage, I think, over Fox's not just a sympathetic coverage of Trump, but sort of muscular defense and drowning out of those who would criticize him in certain ways. And also, you know, particularly the coverage you've seen of the immigration policies that so many have found indefensible.
Well, and let's,
it's not that you can't find voices on Fox opposing the president.
Right.
There are voices there. It's that their dominant figures, their high-rated figures are resolutely on behalf of the president.
Let's listen to some of the moments from the coverage. And this is Laura Ingraham, who complained that the media was using this issue of family separation as a political weapon. She tried to downplay the coverage of the conditions children were being kept in.
So since more illegal immigrants are rushing the border, more kids are being separated from their parents and temporarily housed in what are essentially summer camps, or as the San Diego Union-Tribune described them today, as looking like basically boarding schools.
Essentially summer camps. And then another comment that's gotten a lot of attention came from Corey Lewandowski on Fox News. He's the former Trump campaign manager. He was on a panel last night with former Democratic National Committee advisor Zach Petkanis. Here's the exchange.
I read today about a 10-year-old girl with Down syndrome who was taken from her mother and put in a cage. Read about a did you say want to a 10-year-old with Down syndrome
what
being
I
taken
said
from
is
her
you
mother?
Can pick anything
how
you
dare
want
you?
Down, but the bottom line
how
is very clear.
You?
When you cross
how absolutely
the border
dare you,
illegally.
Sir?
David, your thoughts.
As a journalist, as a citizen, as a parent, contemptible. Beyond sanction or defense. And what was fascinating was to watch the anchor in the middle of them as you watch that video saying and doing nothing, inflectionless, doing nothing to actually referee or acknowledge just the humanity of the moment, whatever your feelings about the policy. You know, journalists have to be arbiters of some notion of humanity and acknowledge that even as they seek fair-minded discourse for of which this represented nothing of the sort. So I think this is, you know, in some ways, even if Fox – this isn't what Fox actually wants, it's what it's engineered to provide, which was outrage from the left and contempt and trolling from the right. That's what you saw there. The outrage on in this particular instance seemed to be 100% earned on the half of the guest criticizing Corey Lewandowski on that.
David, are you seeing any response or reaction to Fox News from the other part of Fox, 21st Century Fox, to this infighting that's happening?
You're seeing the corporate side staying quiet. You know, Fox News will say if you talk about Laura Ingraham and there have been some calls for boycotts of her and that did dampen advertiser enthusiasm for her highly rated primetime show. You know, they'll say we're not going to allow drive-by criticism to snuff out diverse and robust argumentation. They think Ingraham has been taken out of context in some ways. She stepped back a little bit from some of her more severe statements or seemingly severe statements at the front of the week. But, you know, this is one that the corporate side would like to ride out. Let's not forget they are in the business of trying to sell most of their properties to Disney even today as we speak, and they'd like to just sort of ride this out, let it go. You've seen this flashpoint in Hollywood as well as what's happening on the news side.
It's David Falkenflik, NPR media correspondent. David, thank you.
You bet.
Here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Femi Okeh.